Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to introduce myself. I'm Deborah Caldwell Stone. I work for the American Library Association. I work in the Office for Intellectual Freedom, and my job there is to assist librarians and communities that are dealing with censorship issues in their libraries. And today I'd like to talk a little bit about our experience with graphic novel censorship in the library. But I'd like to start out with the good news first, which is that libraries are really getting right into graphic novels. It's a place to go to get graphic novels. I went by the ALA library, and there's all kinds of reader's advisory books talking to librarians about how to acquire books, graphic novels, how to develop their collection. And so it's just a great time right now for as libraries as resources for graphic novels. However, with graphic novels, the censors are really far behind. This deals with a challenge to the Bunny Suicides. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it. It's a little book of comic strips, dark humor about how bunnies commit suicide in various interesting and imaginative ways. And this particular mother felt that it was just not fit for any child to read. And she wanted to burn it. She wanted to ban it. She wasn't going to sleep until it was out of the schools. And so she pursued a challenge to it. And there's many others like her that are right behind her that are challenging graphic novels. And there's many reasons for it, but before I get into that, I'd like to go back into a little bit of history. You may know this already, and I have to give credit to 10 Cent Play. It's a great book by David Higgins about comic censorship in the 40s and 50s. But we have to start with Dr. Frederick Wharton, who decided that the comic books were corrupting the youth of 1940s America, teaching them crime, teaching them how to live bad lives, corrupting them in all ways. And so the result were articles like this that appeared in Collier's in 1948, Horror in the Nursery by Judith Crist. I don't know how many of you know that name, but she ended up being a reviewer for TV Guide for many years in my youth, and I'm not telling you how old I am. But articles like this reached out to communities and to parents, trying to convince them that reading comic books was corrupting, especially the crime comic books from the Golden Age, like Crime Doesn't Pay, and the EC horror comics of the 50s. Wharton started writing his own articles very soon. The first one appeared in Ladies' Home Journal in 1953. The other one was from Saturday Review in 49. But the steady drumbeat started to develop about the horrors of comic books and what they were doing to the minds of children. The Catholic Church got very involved at this point. A bishop in Indiana, Bishop Knoll, organized a group called the National Organization for Decent Literature. And they started establishing chapters in high schools and parochial schools across the country, talking to youth, trying to get youth to give up their comic books, to even lead the crusade against comic books. Of course, it all culminated in Wharton's book, Seduction of the Innocent. It was published, I believe, in 53. And it made a big hit in society, as they say. The end result of the publication of this book were bonfires in the back of schools. Here, this is Binghamton, New York, and the students of St. Patrick's School are burning all their comic books in one giant bonfire to deal with the occasion of sin that comic books represented. But ultimately, there were Senate hearings. At the same time, McCarthy was holding hearings for communists. The Committee on Juvenile Delinquency was holding hearings about comic books. And one of the comic books that was of particular interest to the committee was this EC horror comic with the severed woman's head on it. And increasing pressure was brought on comic book publishers. They started dropping these horror and crime lines. Ultimately, they did what many entertainment industries do when they're threatened with regulation. They adopted voluntary self-censorship. So we end up in the late 50s and early 60s with comic books like Archie and sanitized versions of Batman and Superman. And I have to say, this is my childhood. This is what I remember about comic books when I was growing up as a young child. So why are graphic novels challenged? And some of it's pretty obvious. Images are powerful. They're worth a thousand words. Something that can be that's described in four or five pages can be done in a single panel, and it has real impact on people. And that's one of the things that draws people to graphic novels, but it's also something that can trigger a challenge to a graphic novel in libraries very quickly. Because somebody opens up a book, flips it open, and sees a single panel out of context. So, for example, with Fun Home, you flip it open to a scene of lesbian sex, and you're horrified. But if you read the entire novel, the panel in context becomes part of a wonderful coming-of-age story. But that doesn't matter to the censors. They see the bad pictures, and as a result, they bring the challenges. Another issue. Comics are perceived still in much of the world of our country as for being for kids. At least in average communities, you'll have mothers say, comic books are kids' materials. Why do comic books have sex in them? Why do comic books have to be so in your face? You know, comic books are going to attract kids, you know, by their very nature. And by putting all these pictures of naked people in this comic book, you're trying to corrupt them. Never mind that it's a graphic novel like Blankets, but that's some of the arguments that you hear. And some of the hangover from the 1950s purge of comic books are trashy stuff, and low literature. And this actually not only affects the wider community, it affects the profession as well. There are librarians still today who don't see comic books as being something fit to collect for libraries, or something that you shove on the bottom shelf. Now, there are many reasons why people give for challenging comics and graphic novels. Number one is sex and nudity. You know, as I said, a drawing of a naked woman just sets off all those alarm bells. But violence follows closely behind. Much as was raised by Frederick Wortham, parents are concerned that their kids are learning violent act, you know, how to behave violently, misbehave altogether through graphic novels. Offensive language. Unsuited for age group. This is something we hear all the time. A graphic novel may well be written and directed at a young adult audience, but there'll be that parent who says it deals with topics that no 13-year-old should be thinking about. For example, homosexuality, gay identity, just sex, period. And when you talk about 13-year-olds and not, well, never mind. But another issue that also comes up with graphic novels, particularly because of the images, is racial and ethnic slurs. Now, who challenges? Most of the challengers are parents or grandparents or adult community members who happen to stumble on the book in the library. I'll talk about that with one particular challenge in a few minutes. But there's also organized groups out there. There are organized groups who say that they're there to protect kids, that they're there to defend parents' rights to raise their children the way they see fit. And they believe that this gives them the right to dictate what should be in the library. And it's not just graphic novels that is subject to this group pressure, it's also young adult novels that are increasingly coming under attack by these organized censorship groups. They go under the moniker of family-friendly groups, Citizens for Decency. There's a number of them out there, Safe Libraries. And they can often take a challenge in a community that's only been a concern raised by a single parent and blow it up into a major conflagration in the community. But here's the last one, library staff. I hear at least two or three times a year about library staff censoring graphic novels. For example, I received a call from a librarian in a state I actually can't even name, because she was a young adult librarian who was building the library's graphic novel collection. And she had ordered a raft of graphic novels. And one of them, I believe, was Ellen Forney's I Love Led Zeppelin. And it came in to the cataloging department, you know, the normal order of things. She puts her order in, the box of books arrives at the library, and it goes to the technical services department to be cataloged and marked in preparation for going on the shelf. Well, the woman who was charged with cataloging that graphic novel saw it. Her hair stood on end, and she ran with the graphic novel right to the library director, essentially saying, "We're not going to be putting this filth on our shelf, are we? Especially not for the teenagers." And so, and despite the best efforts of that young adult librarian, that book literally went into the drawer of the library director and never emerged. And so that kind of silent censorship, that kind of self-censorship, is occurring in libraries around the country right now. Now here, Brooklyn, New York, this is an example of the racial or ethnic slur challenge that occasionally happens. And it happens often with these historic graphic novels like Tintin. And here, this was on the shelf. This is actually a 1929 edition of the original book that was on the shelf at the Brooklyn Public Library. And it was shelved in the children's department. And that's where a parent happened upon it. And she brought a challenge to it, saying, "Well, of course you don't want this racial stuff on your shelf." And in this case, the library actually agreed. They took it off the shelf, and the picture that's in the inset there is a vault. And they have a special collection of books that you have to make a written request to see and make an appointment sometime in the indefinite future to see. And Tintin went into that locked vault and can't be seen anymore. And this is a hard question, clearly, because it deals with attitudes from the past that we often don't want to talk about. But there's also a usefulness in being able to see what was done in the past and talk about it, address it in a way that, so that and having access to that book, easy access to that book, both for scholars and for those interested in graphic novels as a whole, is important. Marshall, Missouri. This is an example of the citizen just walking in and picking up something at the new arrival's desk, wondering what the book is about, and then finding that one panel that has sex in it. She flipped through both of these books, which had just been acquired by the Marshall Public Library in Missouri, and the citizen was just horrified to find out that these comic books, which after all are targeted to children, had all the sex stuff in them. So she brought a challenge to the graphic novels. And that's when the library found out it didn't have a policy for dealing with challenges to books. How many here are librarians already? Lots of you. They told me my audience was going to be the general public, so apologies if I'm reiterating things you already know. But the Marshall, Missouri situation is a special example of why you need written policies in your library to deal with challenges, not only to graphic novels, but to any other book. Because they had no means of dealing with it, the board had no methodology to follow. They just automatically took the books off the shelf in response to the challenge. And over a slow 6-month period, there were like 5 public meetings of the library board, they hammered out a collection development policy. And that whole time, these books were off the shelf and in the director's office, unavailable to the public. I worked with this particular librarian on a regular basis as they developed their policy. And ultimately, they adopted the policy. They sent the books to a reconsideration committee who found that they had been acquired in accordance with the collection development policy, fit the need of the library community, and the books were returned to the shelf. Probably, Fun Home was originally shelved with adult books. Blankets was shelved in the young adult area. It was moved to the adult shelf for graphic novels. Well, just in County, Kentucky, you may have already heard of, this is a situation where 2 library workers were so horrified by the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen Black Dossier that they tried to keep it out of circulation. And we have a special guest here. David Powell is the librarian from Jessamine County, Kentucky, who actually purchased the graphic novel and was supervising these 2 workers. And I'd like to invite him to come up and talk about a situation.
Good afternoon. I'm just going to talk about our collection for just a second before I launch into this, and myself, because I think it reflects on the collection, to just give you some background on how a lot of this started. I am the circulation manager at the Jessamine County Public Library. I also do the computers, and as part of my duties, I'm on collection development by the CDs, DVDs, and the graphic novels and comic books. Thus, 90% of the things that are going to get challenged in our library are things I bought. I've been a lifelong comic book, graphic novel fan. I've probably read over 90% of the thousands of comics we have in our collection. Comic book people who are big fans often compliment our collection because it is so big and vast, and I think my lifelong knowledge of it has helped me. The Black Dossier was a book that came out in 2007 and won many awards. We actually had it on the shelf very close to the date of release because I had a hold on it. I would have bought it anyway, but we had a hold on it that someone requested it, wanted it as soon as possible. Because if you know anything about comic books, Alan Moore is one of the most celebrated authors in comic books. And that really ended up helping us quite a bit in our controversy. If they would have picked something with a less known author, I think we would have struggled even more than we did. And of course, Kevin O'Neill's a very celebrated artist. Well, this came out, and I can't talk about employee issues because those are all HR things that I'm sure most people can understand. However, I can talk about what was in the newspapers and what happened at public meetings. And luckily, most of the things in the newspapers explain a lot. I can't verify or say what's true and untrue. I'll leave that up to you. But what I will say is we have a very strong collection development policy, and if you do not have that at your library regarding censorship, you really need one because it helps. Not only do you need the challenge form and procedure, you need something that addresses censorship and what you buy and not buy. And we had that. So that really helped us a lot. Basically, this book was on the shelf for 2 years before we had a problem with it. It circulated a total of, I think, it was under 20 times. It was not a big circulator for us, not like Alan Moore's other works, such as Watchmen, in the first two volumes. This is not personally my favorite volume of the series, although it's become one of my favorite ones for many reasons. But basically what happened was we had a staff member who's on my staff who found a book, or someone else found a book, brought to her attention. She came and spoke to me and said, this book is pornography and we shouldn't have it on the shelf. A child could see it. And I thanked her for her concern, and we discussed it. And I said, you know, but I feel pornography is a very loaded word. So we discussed it, and I said, well, the proper procedure for this is to challenge it. I said, as a library staff member, that is totally within your right, especially since you also live in the community and are a cardholder. So she challenged it, and since I'm on collection development, I was there too, but I stayed mostly silent. I supplied facts on that. I supplied facts about the book, reviews, and that type of stuff, and I got to vote, but I didn't try and sway anyone's vote one way or the other. It was unanimous for all the voting members, once everyone had read the book, to keep it. So we kept it, and we explained to her that we were going to have it. So after a while, it was discovered, and I can't go into how, that this library employee was checking out the item over and over and over and over again to keep it off the shelves. And I can say all that because she said all that to the papers several times. And she has said in the paper that it was her intention to keep it off the shelves so that she was protecting children. And also, she admitted in the papers and everything else that a hold came through on the item. And so then she went into the computer, saw who had the hold, because she couldn't renew it with the hold on it. and discovered it was an 11-year-old girl. So she discussed this with some other library employees, and one of them said, well, we'll just take the hold off. And this other employee took the hold off. This was discovered, and of course we have a confidentiality policy that says you cannot look at people's records for any other reason than for just the normal, everyday business of the library, and this goes beyond that. They took the hold off, it was discovered, and their employment was ended. So this is where the fun started. What happened next was these ladies were upset that they were fired. As a lot of people who challenge books or censors, they were legitimately concerned. And I can totally understand on a personal level and respect their convictions to this and why they didn't want to have it. I disagree with it. And in fact, I really like these employees and still do. I'm not sure how they feel about me anymore. But I think what happened was we had a value, their personal values versus the professional ethics we have to exercise as library staff and librarians. So what happened next was they went to their churches and their friends and the news media and wanted everyone to know about how the Jessamine County Public Library has a porn section. And there was a lot of misinformation, or you know how the game telephone works. You say one thing, and then pretty soon we had people coming in saying, we want to see the porn section of the library, who'd never been in our building, of course. And we had a lot of people who just were not library users. We had at a board meeting, the next board meeting, they came, and 75 people showed up. We hardly ever, probably as most librarians, you probably have hardly any members of the public show up. We had 75. And they weren't on the agenda to speak, which was one of our things, and so they were upset because they didn't get to speak and yell. So we made the next meeting, we put them on the agenda. We had an open forum, and we made rules about how many people could register and everything else. And so the next meeting, we had a public forum, and people had to register, but they had to be a card holder. So all of a sudden, our cards shot up that month in registration. So most of these people weren't even library users, but I'm glad they have cards now, so now they can be. And most of them had not read the book, which was very apparent. So the ladies, they could not speak unless they wanted to sign a confidentiality agreement with the employer. They would not, so they had many people speak on their behalf. We had many preachers speak, but we also had many members of our community who came out and spoke about First Amendment rights. So it ultimately came down to an issue between the First Amendment, parents' rights, and versus the community's rights to protect children. So from there, we listened to all the grievances. They submitted a petition, which isn't how you challenge a book. How that happened was that one of the preachers to the ladies went around to their membership of their churches and got signatures all throughout the county, showing them specific parts of the book, you know. There was also a report, one of the employees said, when she had to fill the challenge out, she said, I didn't want to read it, but I did, so I could fill out that form, and the whole time I did it, I had people praying over me. So this was very much, we got a lot of support from all across the country, and the news went all across the country about what was going on. In fact, one of the people who came to our support in his blog was Neil Gaiman, which a lot of stuff, it was only our community, really, and that really had a problem with this. And there were a lot, I hate to give them hindsight things, but there were a lot of things that they could have done. They were not organized. It was not clear what they wanted. People wanted everything from the book taken off the shelf to a committee that would of citizens that would decide, that would look at every book that was coming into the collection, which means, I mean, why have librarians if you're going to do that? I mean, so it was very interesting. Ultimately, you know, as most things, it just died down and it's kind of gone away. But the ladies made a lot of statements like we were denying them unemployment. We have nothing to do with unemployment. That's decided at a state level. So, you know, they ultimately got their unemployment. It was denied first for them, and then they got their unemployment. And it's just kind of faded away. But a positive of it, it gave us a lot of publicity. You know, at the time, not good publicity, but I'm not sure any bad publicity. Maybe there's not really any bad publicity. So what ended up happening, the silver lining of all this was, we got in contact with Neil Gaiman and thanked him for his support. And then we got to talking with him through the internet and set up a program to go on the internet, to be broadcast live on the internet, which happened this past Monday, where myself and my friend and colleague Juliana Gaddis interviewed him for National Library Week and talked for him for 2 hours. We had over 900 different streams going on simultaneously. 128 of them were in public libraries. So who knows how many people we had actually watching. And we had people watching all over the world. We had Australia, Switzerland, Germany. It was really great, and it should be archived and up at yourlibraries, .org. I believe that's the website. Sometime next week. We're hoping it would be for today, but not yet. So that's kind of the story. But the book's there. We had a lot of people from all across the country send us in donated copies of the book. So, and our circulation of the book went skyrocketed. So we now have 3 copies on the shelf, and I have a stash of them, so if they disappear, I easily put one back out. And a lot of interest in the book. It was unfortunate that a lot of people in our community, were resistant to really stand up. We had a number of speakers come to our aid the day we had took public comment, but a lot of people didn't really want to get involved because these were their neighbors, and we're a pretty conservative county. So I can only speculate, and I won't, because I'm sure this will be reported on and going on the internet, but as to why that is. But ultimately, it's turned out good for the best. But I'm glad. I think the book deserves to be on the shelf. There's always a fine line between selection and censorship. But I pretty much buy almost anything that people want. So as long as it has some merit and good reviews behind it. But it's been a good experience overall for us. But it's been very interesting how it all came about. So thank you.
Thank you, David. David was a little too modest to mention this, but for those of you who are library professionals, the Jessamine County Library has been awarded the Imroth Award, which is an award given each year by the Intellectual Freedom Roundtable for those who exemplify the defense of intellectual freedom in the profession. So there'll be a representative at the ALA annual meeting to receive that award this year. But there are many lessons to be learned from the Jessamine County situation, which is, you know, never let, you need your policy, certainly. But you also need to keep an eye on your PR. You need to be backed up with reviews. You need to be able to have a core of the community you can call on as a library to support you in these situations. We often find that censorship doesn't succeed when you have a strong friends group, when you have strong defenders who will show up at library board meetings and tell the library board that there's more than one view in the community, because that's ultimately the lie that's told by censors, is that theirs is the prevailing view, theirs is the only view in the community. And they try to convince the library board to remove the book on that basis. And of course, that's not true. So this is what's next. We just got this challenge in a day ago. Bone is in the elementary school libraries in Minnesota, the Independent School District 196 near Rosemont. And a mother picked it up and was just horrified that, you know, there's all this scatological and sex humor available to elementary school students. So that school library system, actually it's the school board, has started the challenge process. And so we'll see what happens with Bone. But it just shows you, you go from the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen to Bone in just a very short period of time. Now, as I explained, I was told that my primary audience would be general public and readers, so this is less of a professional presentation than a presentation for those who are interested in defending the right to read from on the other side of the circulation desk. However, for those of you who are librarians, we did bring Graphic Novels in Libraries, which is our handbook on dealing with graphic novels in your library, challenges in your library, development of policies, where you can go to help for help with challenges in your library. But what we're trying to do now in OIF is not only talk to professionals, but to do outreach to the general public. And so we're revamping some of our Banned Books Week materials to do that. And we have a new handout here called Take Action. And this will actually be incorporated into the Banned Books Week shortlist. Every year we issue that nice little three-page slick that lists the books that have been challenged for the year. It's not going to have order forms and other professional stuff anymore. It's going to be something you can hand to the members of your community and to talk about banned books and censorship. And so this little screed is about how the regular member of the community can defend the right to read. And so the points we make is, of course, inform yourself about censorship. We have a list of electronic newsletters to subscribe to, groups to join, particularly the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund and the Freedom to Read Foundation. ALA is affiliated with the Freedom to Read Foundation, and we're very, very close friends with the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund. And in fact, Charles Brownstein and I worked together on the Jessamine County situation for several weeks as it was developing. We're also encouraging people to start getting involved with their library board and school boards. Know what's going on there. Because often censorship will happen because one person shows up and says, this book is filth, and the board members take them at their word. And so it's important to encourage, you know, if you're not a professional, get involved. Start keeping track of what's going on at your library board and your school board, because that's where challenges often start. Somebody shows up for the public comment session of the meeting and says, I found this book. It stinks. I found this graphic novel, and it's horrible, and it shouldn't be in the hands of children. And without a countervailing voice there, without somebody to monitor, often it will go awry. When there are some people who are interested, who are attending, censorship won't happen. That's the lesson from Jessamine County. That's the lesson we got from West Bend, Wisconsin. If you recall last year, that's the library district where they got a demand to burn a Francesca Leah Block young adult novel, Baby Bebop. What happened there is that there were enough involved citizens that they formed a group called West Bend Parents for Free Speech. And every time the West Bend Parents for Citizens for Safe Libraries showed up, the West Bend Parents for Free Speech were there as well. And so ultimately, the library board had lots of support when they voted to keep all the books that were challenged on the shelf. The second thing is support your library. And libraries need support these days. They need friends groups to help with lobbying for more funding. They need just general volunteer work to make up for the staff they can't afford to have on at full time anymore. Libraries are in a real tough place right now, and just being involved with your library is a real important thing. And then here's the other thing. Challenge censorship whenever it occurs. And this goes whether you're a professional or you're a layperson. You know, when somebody says, let's remove this book, when somebody says that this doesn't belong in a library, doesn't belong in a comic book store, when somebody's arrested for selling perfectly legal comics in a small town, they need help and support. We need citizens to step forward and write letters to the editor, to comment on blogs, to go to meetings and speak up. Because again, when people speak up, it's a lot harder for the other side to convince those in charge that theirs is the correct view or the only view in charge. So at this time, I'd be happy to take questions, talk about any kinds of topics that fall into our purview at the Office for Intellectual Freedom. I do have copies of challenge books if for anybody who's interested in seeing them. I'll just be I'll be happy to take any questions that you have. Yes, sir.
Is part of the ignorance of people just having ignorance of the material, because I read, was about 6 months ago, a woman wanted a Spider-Man band because Mary Jane was in the bikini.
Well, you'll find, I wouldn't say that that's ignorance so much. And, you know, we do, as David was careful to say, and I think it's important to remember, the people who raise these concerns, by and large, are, you know, concerned for their children, are concerned for children in the community. And I don't want to dismiss that lightly. On the other hand, it's clear that we have a wide range of personal values and beliefs in this country, and some of them go to the place where young men shouldn't be looking at young women in bikinis, whether they're photographs or drawn, and they'll raise an objection based on that. I think that, yes, if people were more familiar with graphic novels, if there was an opportunity for them to read graphic novels like Owlie, to get them into what graphic novels can do for you as a reader, it might be better. I actually keep giving people copies of Fun Home because I say, here it is. This is a graphic novel, which is undeniably literature. The finest kind, and you can't call it a comic book or dismiss it as comic books anymore. Not that I'm doing it. I love comic books, collect them myself and everything, but, it's for those who are still weighted down with the idea that comic books are trash for small children, books like Mouse and Fun Home can often bring somebody into the fold. Are there any other questions? Yes, ma'am. Sir, sorry.
At my school, we have all these things. In fact, I found trouble. But I look, and we don't have a single graphic novel. How could I get out of
it? Well, if your library doesn't have a particular graphic novel or comic in, and they collect graphic novels as a normal thing, usually the collection development policies have a process by which individual users can go to the librarian and ask them to collect a particular book. Of course, libraries aren't obligated to buy particular books. It's just impossible. They don't have room on their shelves, their budgets are limited, and things like that. You may find that the librarian, him or herself, has a particular objection to that graphic novel, and that's a situation where it may take some persuasion, or you may need to get it through interlibrary loan. That's another way of getting a graphic novel into your library that might not otherwise get in. School libraries are a more difficult challenge because they do have a different mission than the public library. They're supposed to be supporting the curriculum, and while they do collect books to expand the reading of students in support of the literature curriculum, the reading curriculum, they are sometimes can be more sensitive about particular subject matter and will avoid more adult editions of the superhero comics for some and things like that. So there's no good way of just approaching that, but if they haven't been turned down yet and they're not telling you that they don't want to buy it, ask them to buy it. See what you get. Offer to help out. Say, I'd love to volunteer and help you pick out new graphic novels for the collection and things like that and see what happens. Yes, sir.
That's a question. It's just something that I've noticed. I developed the graphic novel section in our library, mm-hmm. and one of our policies is we try to have everything reviewed. Well, something I've noticed with graphic novels is although they will have reviews, they're not nearly as highly reviewed or widely reviewed as traditional literature. So like if I pull any YA book, I will find a review in school library journal, whatever else, whereas a graphic novel will be reviewed in Publishers Weekly, that's actually been kind of a hardship that I've been having, especially in the case of manga. And a lot of kids, those are some of our heaviest library users, the manga kids, and one does not produce manga, it makes it hard to learn.
Yeah. This is some, you know, I know that Booklist, they're on our floor in the ALA building, National Hall, is developing more graphic novel reviews. You know, some of that's limited, you know, they can't review everything and things, and so they get what they get from the publishers. And so one thing is to encourage publishers to send their books for review to the library press, you know, or to the professional journals that review this. But the other thing is to get involved with the graphic novel librarians groups online and in ALA and help them develop materials. I know that YELSA, for example, is developing materials for graphic novels for teens. I believe that we're doing our best. I know that ALA is hugely enthusiastic about graphic novels, witness the fact that we're here with a booth and speakers all weekend. So the support is there, and I think it's just expressing the need to Booklist, American libraries, to see if we can't push for more, like, a spotlight. I know, in fact, that Booklist does a spotlight on graphic novels, but maybe doing that more than once a year would be a help. So, yes, ma'am.
I wanted to say, in relation to what you were saying about reviews, sometimes you just have to think outside the box, and I don't know what your library accepts as acceptable publications, but there are lots of reviews of comics and graphic novels, either at the Comics Journal, which you can find online, at comic news websites and things like that. Some of them are moving here, where they do review individual issues in graphic novel compilations. Sometimes manga's real spotty. But you have to, in some ways, you have to ask yourself, like, what kind of reviews are acceptable? Are reviews by a comic industry publication acceptable for a library? Are reviewed, or do they have to come from the traditional book world? Because I think you see a tension there between what the industry does, that the library world, Publishers Weekly, Booklist, School Library Journal, has no clue, really, what the comics industry does. And I came into librarianship from a comic book store background, so I might be aware of some of these things, but I think overall you have to sort of think outside the box about where your reviews come from. Because sometimes they are out there, they're just not going to come delivered to your, you know, tech services office, you know, in that Publishers Weekly format that they're used to seeing.
Yes, ma'am.
Can I just add to that? I'm kind of frightened with that because I actually edited a blog called The Comics for Kids. It's on the SLJ website. Sorry to advertise myself. But five of my bloggers are librarians. And we also link to reviews both on comic sites and on library and traditional book sites. So we're trying to fill that gap right now.
And I will say that one of the services that OIF supplies to libraries and librarians is that we'll hunt down those reviews for you. We have full-time staff and library staff at ALA, and when a challenge report comes in, we'll go out and we'll dig up all those reviews and fax them or email them to you within a day. So when you're dealing with a challenge, we'll be happy to help you with all that. Just call 4223 at the 800 number at ALA. And tell them that you have a challenge and that you need help identifying reviews. I will tell you that one of the ALA library staff is a huge comics fan, and she takes great relish in digging out this information whenever there's a graphic novels challenge. So we can do that as well. Yes, David?
I also wanted to add, a comics buyer's guide has shown me a lot of really good books to buy. Might not be as respected as a lot of our professional journals, but they have sent me to a lot of things. The other two things I want to say, this doesn't help you in a challenge so much, but get to know your local comic book shop. They help you a lot. And in fact, I buy from a local comic book shop. He was able to match me on the discount we would have gotten from Baker, Taylor, or whatever. And we've actually become really
point that I should have made back when we were talking about Jessamine County. But one thing that we're recommending to avoid hassles, for lack of a better phrase, is to make sure that you're shelving the graphic novels for age appropriateness. You don't want to just put all the graphic novels in one place. You want to put the stuff that's aimed at the 8 to 10-year-old in the children's section, the young adult stuff in the young adult section, and then, you know, novels that are clearly adult-themed in the adult fiction area, because that will avoid, actually give you an argument when you are do receive a challenge and help address the argument that you're aiming this stuff at kids, you know. And in fact, that's this was, you know, we were working with Jessamine County, and when they were facing demands to, they actually got demands to require written permission to access, to create a, essentially an adult section of the library where you would have to show an ID to get into it, much as an adult bookstore and things like that. The ultimate solution that we was arrived at was, in fact, making sure that all the graphic novels were shelved in an age-appropriate fashion. And no changes were made to library policy. So kids maintained full access to the collection. None of the books came off the shelves. There was no draconian requiring written parental permission kind of things that were put in place. So that's another thing to keep in mind. Are there other questions? Yes, ma'am. Yeah. You know, some of it is talking to them about the art of telling a story with images as well as words. And there are resources. Some of these, you know, I don't have particular titles at hand, but there's a new book out right that's edited by Martha Cornog on graphic novels. Libraries Unlimited is publishing it. Don't let ALA Editions hear you say I said that. But she has a whole section on talking to people about graphic novels who don't have a graphic novel background. But the other thing you have to do is sometimes just step up and say that adult-themed storytelling has a place in the public library as much as youth books or children's books, and that you serve a diverse audience, and that there are those who find this kind of storytelling interesting and compelling. And that as a public library, they're taxpayers too. They have, you know, that you're serving their needs as well. And that may sometimes involve stories that talk about sex. And it's no better or no worse than Tropic of Cancer, Lady Chatterley's Lover, all of which were challenged because they dealt with sex, you know, and that, you know, it's just getting to the point of, and I have to confess, I grew up reading comic books and graphic novels, and so it's hard for me too to make that leap conceptually. I'm a generation apart, but I'm convinced that if you start bringing people along, saying this is a legitimate form of storytelling, you know, you go and you sit down and you watch television. What is that but telling stories through sound and images? And this is another way of telling stories with images without sound. That's as legitimate and celebrated as television or movies. And so here, why don't you try this one? You know, and develop a short bibliography of introductory graphic novels that that you can bring somebody into to the genre. So.
As a follow-up, what, say, four would you recommend?
Oh, that's hard for me. Actually, David, why don't you talk about what you think would be a great... I mean, I have my favorite... Actually, I brought some of my favorites here. Watchmen's here, Mouse, Fun Home, which is slightly difficult, but I think it's presented in such a way that anybody with a level of this, you know, any adult person will identify with the coming-of-age story. But do you have any others, David?
Well, you know, until you showed that slide, I recommend Bone for all ages most of the time. I think it's a great, I've read a number of kids that I know. I used to be an elementary school teacher, and I'd encourage them. I never had a problem with it, so I was really surprised to see that up there.
Well, it just goes to show.
But adults love it, too.
Yeah. So, you know, I think that's the kind of thing you need to do, you know. Anyhow, it looks like I have to wrap up here. Are there any other questions? Well, thank you for coming. I appreciate your attention. Thank you.